From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you up to date on the news that made headlines this last week. A lot to get to today. And today our panel includes Ian Mac Stevenson with the Idaho Statesman, Christina Lords, the editor-in-chief of the Idaho Capital Sun, Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, and Alex Brezzi, criminal justice reporter with the Idaho Statesman. Alex is joining us for this first segment, so we wanted to begin with her. Alex, thanks for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for having me on.
So, Alex, I want to start with what happened Saturday night. So this is almost a week ago, but take us back to Saturday evening in Boise when reports came in about an officer-involved shooting.
Yeah, so on Saturday night, we started hearing some reports that there had been some kind of police shooting or incident kind of up on the Boise bench. And once we looked into it, we heard that a deputy from the sheriff's office was actually the one who got shot. And his name is Deputy Tobin Bolter. And he was conducting a traffic stop around 9 p.m. Saturday night up kind of on Overland Road around South Raymond Street, which is kind of up on the bench by that Fred Meyer. And when he pulled over a man named Dennis Mulquin, who was 65, for what appeared to be a routine traffic stop. We're not exactly sure the specific reason why he stopped Mulquin, but we know that Dennis Mulquin had a warrant out for his arrest, about a $3,000 warrant, which is a minor misdemeanor warrant. And we later learned it was for a DUI, so nothing major. And when he pulled him over, before he even made it to the window, Dennis Mulquin shot him and fled the scene. And a nearby citizen actually called 911 and the paramedics arrived. And they took Deputy Bolter to the hospital where unfortunately he died the next morning. And then kind of in between that time while Deputy Bolter was being transported to the hospital and everything, the Boise Police Department started looking for Mulquin and they found him in a nearby neighborhood. And kind of after some back and forth, he was kind of, I think it seems like he was maybe outside of a home and they were trying to go back and forth with him. And about midnight, he actually fired at officers. And so then a Boise police officer who hasn't been identified fired back, hitting him and he died from that injury.
So Alex, I know that there was a news conference that was held Sunday morning to give an update about Deputy Bolter. Can you talk a little bit about this? Because it was emotional, I think, to say the least, because my understanding is that Deputy Bolter did live through the night.
He did. He did live through the night. And it seems like our understanding is that he passed away moments, maybe less than an hour before the press conference. And so I think it was really emotional, especially emotional for Ada County Sheriff Matt Clifford. You know, this is the first deputy to die in the line of duty for the Ada County Sheriff's Office. So it was a really emotional morning. And he was lined up, you know, with several other police leaders. Boise Police Chief Ron Weiniger was also there along with some other, you know, very obviously some of the top leaders for the Idaho law enforcement. And, you know, they were very emotional, obviously so.
And Alex, in the midst of all of this, there was another incident. And I know it got kind of confusing, was that another deputy was involved in a car crash, correct? Trying to get to the scene. So can you talk about that? And I only ask this because there was some confusion with all of this information coming in and people trying to piece together what was happening.
Yeah. So the other deputy Alice Denny, she was on her way to respond, and while in the midst of that, was involved in a two vehicle car crash. So another person, a civilian, in a car was also injured, and that driver was taken to the hospital as well. And both Deputy Denny and the other driver were both taken to the hospital with non life threatening injuries, but it's, at least for the deputy, they were still serious. And so she was later released from the hospital. And we actually found out, I believe yesterday, that she's since been cited with an infraction by Idaho State Police for due regard. And so we're not fully sure what all that means just yet, but it seems like somewhat in the way that she was going, there was some kind of, so there's going to be some kind of investigation into that. And the sheriff's office will be looking at their policies as well. But she is all right. And she's back home. She did suffer some quite severe injuries.
Mm-hmm. And Alex, I know you said during this news conference, I mean, it was quite obvious how emotional everyone was, in particular, Sheriff Matt Clifford. And as you said, this is the first officer who has died in the line of duty for the Ada County Sheriff's Office. If my recollection serves me, we have not, thank goodness, had a officer die in the line of duty in almost 30 years, going back to Boise Police Officer Mark Stahl.
That's correct. Yeah, there hasn't been an officer or a deputy who has been killed you know, in the Treasure Valley since 1997, when Mark Stahl was killed, which was also actually a kind of a traffic violation stop, that it was a bit different circumstance, but kind of started in a similar way. And thankfully, there actually hasn't been, in general, many officers who have died in the Treasure Valley in decades and decades and decades of the last one was Mark Stahl.
And going back to the suspect in this, and we do know that, as you said, Alex, officers did shoot him. Our understanding is that he started shooting at these officers. And so he was shot and killed. What more do we know? As you said, we knew that he had a $3,000 warrant out, but did he have more of a criminal history? And so answer that question first, and then I have another one.
Sure. So yeah, I'm actually still diving a little bit into trying to learn a little bit more about who he was and what, you know, what was going on with him. But what we know so far is that it seems like he had a somewhat of a criminal history dating back for a while, but none of it was overly violent. A lot of it was open container violations, so, you know, drinking in public, kind of minor routine stuff there. I believe there was like a resisting, maybe arrest charge, but most of them were misdemeanors. I'm pretty sure he never spent any time actually in prison. Maybe just kind of in and out of jail. So nothing really that, you know, went to the level of obviously what has since happened.
Mm-hmm. So Alex, is there an investigation ongoing into this? And the reason why I ask that is the suspect has been killed. So there will be no charges brought. So is it closed, or are they trying to find out as to why this would happen? Because it is frankly shocking. I think that something as simple as a traffic stop, right, where the officer doesn't even get to the car, that something like this happens.
No, and so they are looking into it a bit. They've asked, law enforcement has asked, like, anyone who might have actually seen Dennis Mulquin on or around Friday or Saturday, in the kind of the days leading up to the shooting, if they know any information, to please contact the sheriff's office, or maybe even the Boise Police Department. Just reach out to law enforcement if you knew him, if you saw something those couple nights. And I think they're trying to piece together, you know, what he was doing in those last few days, and, you know, trying to learn more about what actually happened, because I don't think they fully know.
Yeah. And what do we know about Deputy Bolter, Alex?
Yeah. So there has been quite a lot of community support and people kind of speaking out, not necessarily directly his family, but, you know, others who have remembered him. There's been several vigils in the Treasure Valley since his death, and more coming. And I've seen hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people out. And so through those vigils, we've kind of learned a little bit about him. And it sounds like there was two things he always wanted. He wanted to always be a police officer or a deputy. And he was a very religious man and wanted to glorify God and kind of bring light, you know, to others with his religious beliefs. So those are some of the, I think, the two kind of main pillars we've learned. And then also we've learned that he was married and he loved his wife very much. And she's actually pregnant with their first child.
And I mean, it is, there are no words about how devastating this is, and how it reaches the entire community. As you said, Alex, I mean, he was 27 years old, had he only been with the Ada County Sheriff's Office for a short time, but he did have a bit more experience in law enforcement. He just had changed positions, correct?
Yes, he had joined the sheriff's office in January and previously spent I believe, maybe a year and a half with the Meridian Police Department. And before that, he actually came up here from California. And he grew up in a town called Walnut Creek, which is just outside the Bay Area. And he worked at a neighboring police department, which I think is where he spent pretty much the, where he got his start in the majority of his career outside of some time in the academy, in a town called Pleasant Hills. So he had been in law enforcement for about a total of 7 years. So not completely new, but newer to the Idaho area.
And we've learned information about his memorial service. Can you share that information with us? Because there are parts that will definitely be private that not the public or the media will be at. But I think there is an outpouring, as you said, of community that wants to support and lift up his family.
Yeah. And so the funeral is planned for this coming Tuesday at 3 p.m. at the Ford Idaho Center out in Nampa. The indoor service is going to be reserved for his family, friends, and then obviously law enforcement as well. But community members who would like to observe and also the media and stuff can watch from the outdoor amphitheater, or there's also going to be, the service will be live streamed on the sheriff's YouTube channel.
Okay. And that is Tuesday, you said?
Yes, Tuesday.
Okay. Alex, thank you so much. I know that these stories are never easy to cover, but really appreciate, they're not. So really appreciate all of the reporting that you and your colleagues at the Idaho Statesman have done on this. And thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on and being able to tell people a little bit more about Deputy Bolter.
Yeah, it's important. Thank you. We've been talking with Alex Bruzzi, criminal justice reporter with the Idaho Statesman. We've been talking about Saturday's fatal shooting of an Ada County Sheriff's deputy. As we said, his memorial service will be Tuesday at the Idaho Ford Center. And of course, it is open in the amphitheater to the public. Clark, primary elections, they are right around the corner. And there are some pretty important deadlines today, right, that people should know about?
Yeah, Gemma, you're absolutely right. There's an important deadline today for early registering to vote, basically online voter registration ahead of the May 21st primary election. And we can kind of get into what it is, but this is really important for people who are going to vote by absentee ballot is what is really important about today's online early voter registration deadline. And if you miss today's deadline, there are still opportunities to register to vote at the polls when you go to vote on the day of the primary election, or if you vote in early voting. But to vote by absentee ballot, you have to be registered beforehand in order to request your ballot. But it's easy to do. If you need to update your voter registration status, or if you need to register to vote for the first time, you can go to voteidaho.gov, which is the state of Idaho's official voting information website from the Idaho Secretary of State's office. They just revamped this website in the last year and made it more mobile friendly and made it as kind of a easy place where folks can go to get all the information they would need for the election. But you can go to voteidaho.gov and click on voting and voter registration, and that will guide you to what you need to do if you're registering to vote for the first time, or if maybe you've moved and you just need to update your voter registration details. That's a good place to do it. But while you're at that website, you can also get all kinds of information about the candidates that are running for office. And I know Christina and I were just talking at our newsroom planning meeting yesterday about getting geared up for the primary election. It is May 21st, and this is an important election this year. This is where you're going to have races for county officers, such as county commissioner, prosecutor, but also these committee precinct officer positions. These precinct committeemen is what they're called, that really make up the grassroots of the political parties. These will be up for election during the primary election. And then every seat in the Idaho legislature, both in the Idaho House and the Idaho Senate, is up. And depending on where exactly you live, you may or may not have a contested legislative race. But it is an important election. The election itself is May 21st. But today, Gemma, like you said, is that early voter registration deadline for folks who are looking to register to vote online and request an absentee ballot. And you can just handle that real quickly and easily at voteidaho.gov, Gemma.
And Clark, just for clarification, and I know you mentioned this, though, if you don't meet that deadline today, As a voter here in Idaho, you can register at the polls on election day, correct? And vote?
Absolutely. Yep. We have same day voter registration in Idaho, but it means you're going to be voting in person if you miss today's early voter registration deadline. But yep, absolutely. If you forget about it, if you get home and you're like, oh my gosh, I missed it, then yep, you can still register to vote at the poll on the day of the primary election when you go to vote. Or if you go down, like if you go down to City Hall and do early voting, you can also register to vote at that time. But for folks who are looking to do absentee ballots, today is a really important deadline if they have not already registered to vote or updated their latest information, such as their address or any name change or anything like that since the last election.
Okay, thanks for that update. That is important deadline information to know about. Christina, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments earlier this week from the state of Idaho in its fight not to have to follow EMTALA. Before we get into some of the reporting that your news organization has done, can you quickly, for folks who may not be following this, tell us about this case very quickly and what EMTALA is?
Sure. I can go over the case and then some of the ramifications that we've seen from or that doctors have seen while they're kind of in limbo here. So on Wednesday, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments for a case relating to Idaho's abortion ban and how doctors say it could prevent some women from receiving medical treatment by way of abortion if they have severe complications with their pregnancies and need to terminate that pregnancy to protect the mother's health or even her life. The Supreme Court justices are expected to decide whether doctors who might need to terminate a pregnancy during a health emergency would be protected from criminal prosecution under what's known as the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, or EMTALA. So that's a federal law that requires hospitals to treat patients who come to an emergency room regardless of their ability to pay. And the arguments on Wednesday took about 2 hours. The court's decision may take months to be released. I think the earliest anyone expects to see a decision might be toward the end of June. So doctors are still feeling very uncomfortable with the situation that they're in. And if the court decides that the law does not provide that protection to physicians, then some doctors in Idaho have said that they will have to continue to transfer patients out of state for emergency treatment. So since January, that's when the Supreme Court decided to take the case and it struck down an injunction that provided doctors protection under EMTALA. Those sort of emergency transfers out of state for pregnancy complications that may require termination increased from one reported in 2023 to six over the course of the first 4 months of 2024. So we're seeing this increase, right? And St. Luke's medical officer, Dr. Jim Souza, said that if that pace continues, that number could actually be about 20 patients before the year is over. And one Boise doctor that we talked to said that the longer an infection or other complications persist, the greater risk it poses to a patient's health and the ability to get pregnant in the future. So with all that in mind, some doctors are actually encouraging their pregnant patients to sign up for air ambulance insurance and memberships to services such as Life Flight in case they do need to be transferred out of state to avoid these incredible, like super expensive costs that are associated with these transfers. We found that the average cost of these emergency air transport flights is between $12,000 and $25,000 before insurance is applied. And that's like on the low end of the scale that we found. So we have this story on our website about how some doctors are really encouraging their patients to look into this option. A membership for Life Flight costs $85 for 1 year for a household, while Air St. Luke's charges about $60 for a year. But even relying on something like that with a membership, doctors say there are drawbacks to relying on that type of care because air ambulances are just not as well equipped to handle emergencies as hospitals. So complications can happen mid-flight. Obviously, there's not a lot of wiggle room in an air ambulance or a Life Flight. So it's the patient, right? And then the family members would have to travel to wherever the the mother is being treated in the hospital that they've been transferred to. This also removes air ambulance services from the hospital from other people who may need them. And then, of course, if the weather is bad, it just doesn't matter if you have a membership or not. Helicopters just cannot fly in dangerous conditions. So, you know, I think we've been hearing a lot from doctors, and of course, we've talked a lot about on this show of just how vague they feel like the law is, the abortion ban is, and they're just really struggling to try to find ways to offer care to patients that have had access to this care for the last 50 years under Roe v. Wade. And so, yeah, it may be a while before we see the decision from the Supreme Court, but we'll continue to follow this and report on the outcomes for sure.
Right. And if people want to read more, you have this on your website too. Because this has been your state's newsroom doing quite a bit of this reporting, Christina, and I think really explaining how intricate this is. Because it was interesting, I think, with the hearings earlier this week, when attorneys the attorneys for Idaho were asked really about, okay, what about this scenario? What about this scenario? And every answer was doctor's discretion. Right. And it seems that it's just pregnancy is not black and white. And one of these issues then comes down to, as you're reporting, you know, doctors saying maybe look into getting a membership for LifeFlight if you're pregnant in Idaho. It is amazing that we are at this point.
Yeah, I think you can really see between the policymakers, our state lawmakers, our attorney general, they're kind of saying one thing, that doctors do have flexibility, that it's in the law. And then the people that are actually could be charged with these crimes are saying we don't have enough information. We don't have enough wiggle room to make these decisions in real time. They're genuinely scared of criminal prosecution if they do provide an abortion to someone who needs that care to save their life or to protect their health. There's just such a disconnect between policymakers and the doctors that are having to work within the law. And we've seen that since the ban went in 2022. It has just continued to be, more disconnect and doctors are really struggling, I think, or that's what they're telling us at least.
Mm-hmm. And at this point, the ban, is still in effect here in the state of Idaho, Christina, right? Because we are waiting for the U.S. Supreme Court to decide on this, and the likelihood of them deciding before the end of June is pretty rare.
Right. That's what we're being told and what we've been reporting, correct.
Okay. So, Ian, the U.S. Supreme Court made a ruling earlier this month that allows Idaho's ban on gender-affirming care for minors to go into effect. Can you tell us what this means for minors seeking this care? I mean, what's next for them?
Yeah, a lot of Idaho-related business before the U.S. Supreme Court this month. So for now, the gender-affirming care for people under 18 is illegal in Idaho, unless you are one of two plaintiffs and their families who filed suit last year over the state law that was supposed to take effect in January, but was paused until earlier this month when the Supreme Court allowed it to go into effect. So unless you're the two plaintiffs in the case, you can't receive gender-affirming care at the moment. But the Supreme Court's ruling was just over a preliminary matter, and the substance of the case has not yet been addressed. So it's all a bit technical, but here's what comes next. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is going to take up the injunction, which is another way of saying the pause on the law, sometime this summer, and they will rule on the substance of that. So that could mean a number of different outcomes. They might agree with the Supreme Court, which allowed the law to take effect, as I said, for everyone except the two plaintiffs, or they could reinstate the statewide pause that had been effect for the few months preceding that, or they could do something different, something in between those two outcomes. I think one thing that's important to note here is that while the Supreme Court is now dominated by conservative justices, that's not so much the case with the Ninth Circuit, which has historically leaned leftward. So those kinds of differences might affect the outcome of the ruling that we get this summer. And then Once that decision is made, then the case will likely come back to district court in Boise, where the lawsuit itself, the substance of the case, which was filed by the ACLU of Idaho and which claims that Idaho's law against gender-affirming care for minors violates their constitutional rights, then it will proceed in earnest and we'll get eventually in the months and possibly even longer timeframe beyond that, we'll get an outcome on the case itself.
Okay, so if I'm hearing you correctly, Ian, the ban is in effect here in Idaho.
Yes.
So minors who are looking for gender-affirming care cannot get it in Idaho right now. The Ninth Circuit will take... Okay, so then the Ninth Circuit will take this up this summer, but does that mean when they take it up, an injunction happens, or we're still waiting to see what happens and the ban stays in effect?
Yeah, so basically the law was put on pause by a district judge at the end of December when it was supposed, right days before it was supposed to go into effect in January. And the Supreme Court, they intervened this month on an emergency basis. It's on their emergency docket. And they basically said, while this is being adjudicated, while it's moving through the courts, we're going to allow the ban to go into effect. But they didn't rule on the actual substance of the district judge order, and that's what the Ninth Circuit Court is gonna take up. So when they take it up this summer, they could reinstate that injunction or some version or some new version of that injunction and repause the law or allow it to continue. We'll have to see what they decide.
Okay, so just a holding pattern, really, for all of these youth who are wanting and needing this type of care.
Yeah, and I think what's kind of interesting about it is and significant is that part of the reason the district judge initially paused the law for across the state was because the two plaintiffs in the case are anonymous, and he was worried that it wouldn't be possible for them to remain anonymous if if the ban was in effect for everyone except those two people. But that's now what's the reality is on the ground, that if you're one of the two plaintiffs in the case, you're allowed to still receive this care, but if you're not, you can't.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. All right, thank you for the update on that, Ian. Of course, we will all keep watching that to see what happens this summer. Clark, the last segment, we talked about deadlines today about absentee balloting, but absentee ballots. However, there are some deadlines for open primary supporters because they need to turn in signatures next week. So before we get to all of that, first, can you tell us about what they're trying to get on the ballot exactly?
Yeah, for sure, Gemma. And let's just get into it. And if you have any questions, feel free to jump right in. I know the other reporters are probably familiar with it too. But they're trying to get this on the November general election. So not the primary, but they're trying to qualify for November. And this open primary ballot initiative would make important changes to both the primary election and the general election if it passes. The first thing that it would do is that it would end what we have called closed primaries in the state of Idaho, which basically we've had a law on the books in the state of Idaho since 2011 that says the political parties don't have to let voters vote in their primary elections unless the voter is specifically affiliated with that political party. There's an exception to the law, and the Democratic Party has been able to open its primary up, but the Republican primary and all the other primary elections have been closed. And so what this initiative would do is it would get rid of the closed primary elections and replace it with just one primary election where all candidates participated and all voters participated regardless of party affiliation. So you could have three Republicans, two Democrats, and a Libertarian all in the same primary. And then what will happen is the candidates with the four highest vote totals from that primary election will all advance to the November general election. And again, regardless of party affiliation. So you could have two Republicans and two Democrats each move on to the general election. So that's how it would change the primary election. And when we come to the general election with those four candidates, there's going to be changes to how we vote in the general election too. It would put in place a new system for Idaho that would be called ranked choice voting. or instant runoff is what some people call it too. But what would happen is on your ballot, you would pick your favorite candidate, but you could also rank those other three candidates in order of preference, second choice, third choice, and fourth choice on your ballot if you want to. And then when we go to count the votes, the candidate with the fewest number of votes is completely eliminated. And all of the votes that were for that candidate now go to anybody who's marked as a second choice on that voter's ballot. And that process is going to continue until there's just two candidates left. Mm-hmm. And the candidate with the most votes is going to be elected the winner. And with this new instant runoff or ranked choice, it's important to note that there's only going to be one general election and one day of voting for Idahoans. You don't have to go to the polls multiple times. You'll do it all on that same ballot where you're ranking the candidates. You pick your favorite and then you rank the others, second choice, third choice, fourth choice. So it's just one day of going to the polls like always. Mm-hmm. And so that's to me, I've been covering it since last year, since it launched. That to me is the highlights of how the ballot initiative would change elections. And I've talked to supporters of the ballot initiative, and what they're saying is that this would open up elections to be a lot accountable to a lot more Idaho voters. As it is right now, 275,000 unaffiliated voters in Idaho can't vote in a closed primary election. And so it's saying right off the bat, it's going to make these candidates have to be accountable to a wider swath of Idahoans, more general swath of Idaho voters, because more people would be participating. And the opponents I've talked to, really led by Idaho Republican Party Chairwoman Dorothy Moon, have said that this could be a confusing new way of elections, and it's a big change from what Idaho voters are used to, and that it gets away from this idea of one person in one vote. And so that's kind of the pro and the con to it. But what we're coming up on, Gemma, is a very important deadline to turn in the signatures next week on Wednesday, and the supporters think that they've exceeded the number that's required. And the people I talked to have a last chance to sign event coming up in 20 different Idaho towns tomorrow morning on Saturday. And then they're going to be turning the signatures into the county clerks for verification, most likely on Tuesday. Wednesday, May 1st is the big deadline. But when I spoke with Luke Mayville, the co-founder of Reclaim Idaho, he thinks that they're going to be well in excess of the requirements for both the total number of signatures needed and the number of legislative districts. And so he feels really good. He told me he sees a real path to victory in November, and they're hoping to get this on the ballot in November. They get the signatures verified. And then if it does make the ballots, Gemma, it would be on the election in November. And then it would just take a simple majority of voters, a simple 50% plus one of voters for it to pass at the polls. So those are kind of the highlights. I don't know if you have some questions about the deadline or about how the initiative works, but I've been working with Christina to cover it since last year.
No, I know you have. You've been covering this quite a bit and coming on our show and talking to us about this. So really the only other question that I have, Clark, is this. So if this gets on the ballot in November, there would be one initiative, but it seems to be there are two parts to the initiative. The first one being opening up the primary, which happens in May, and then you would go to ranked choice voting in the general election, which is in November, moving forward in Idaho. So one initiative, but two issues on that initiative.
Yeah, it's one package. And so it comes together as one package. So you can't pick like yes to the primary and no to the ranked choice, or yes to the ranked choice. It's going to be one package presented in voters. There was a lot of discussion about this when this was originally put forward last year, and it had a review by the Attorney General's office and the Secretary of State's office. I know that Attorney General Raul Labrador has made public statements in opposition to the initiative, has threatened to sue over it, or perhaps to challenge over it is maybe the more accurate language there, Gemma. But yeah, so this has been talked about, like the ballot language and specifically the mechanics of the initiative, but it will be brought to voters as one item to say yes or no on the whole thing there, if that helps to make sense of it a little bit.
It does. And then once they turn, so they have to turn these signatures in by May 1st. That is the deadline. Everything has to get verified. And then yep. if they, and then how long does it normally take, Clark, for to find out if they have gotten enough signatures so that this initiative can be on the ballot?
Yeah, that's a great question. And there's really two rounds of verification that are about to happen. This deadline next week is really to submit it to the counties, and the county elections officials are going to go through and verify that the signature is a registered voter, that their address matches the voter registration records, that they can read everything legibly, and that the signature matches. That's about a 60-day process from what I've told. After that happens, let's say maybe in early July, the supporters of the initiative will get the results of that round of verification back to the counties, and then they will take it to the state capitol building for a second level of review that will happen at the state level through, I believe, the Secretary of State's office. And that I expect that may happen in early July. And then that kicks off another round of verification. So it could be midsummer until they know officially whether this is verified and certified for the election. But I think within the first 60 days, by the time this first one is over, within 60 days, they're going to have a real good idea, because I think the individual county reviews are a real thorough verification process. And so I think they will know, have a really, really good idea by early July.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, appreciate the update on that as well, Clark. And of course, we'll all be paying attention to that. So, Christina, we have been talking about bird flu on our program for a while now with Dr. David Pate on Wednesdays. And now we are learning about a second case of the bird flu. It's been detected in another herd of dairy cattle here in Idaho. So first off, is this other herd in the same place, Cache County, where the first one was? But after that question is answered, are agricultural officials in our state concerned about this at all?
Yeah, it's a great question. So yeah, on April 1st, the Idaho State Department of Agriculture reported its first case of the bird flu found in cattle in Cache County. Those infected cows had been recently imported from Texas, where this kind of outbreak all began. And on Monday of this week, the department confirmed that a second herd in Cache County is positive. But the Idaho State Department of Agriculture spokesperson told us that the state is well prepared with financial resources and trained staff to respond to animal diseases, and the Idaho farms with infected cattle have been placed under a quarantine to limit the movement of those animals. Other state ag officials we talked to, including the CEO of the Idaho Dairymen's Association, said, you know, they're keeping an eye on the reported infections, but what they're most concerned about is a wider outbreak and what that could do to Idaho's economy, because we're so ag-related. Dairy is a huge part of our, you know, economic ecosystem. And this outbreak in dairy herds primarily affects lactating cows. And so one side effect or symptom of this strain of influenza reduces milk production. So the cows don't die from this, but they also don't produce as much milk as they normally would. And the CEO of the Dairymen's Association told us that ranchers are also, you know, ranchers and dairy producers are already coming off of kind of a bad year with bad margins when it comes to milk prices and things like that. Mm-hmm. So that's what they're worried about, is this financial impact on the dairymen and women of our state. We did talk to an Idaho University of Idaho professor who specializes in veterinary medicine, and she did stress that the milk bought at grocery stores is still safe for human consumption because it's been pasteurized, which means it's been heated to a high temperature to kill harmful bacteria. But the state ag department recommends that these dairy producers do contact their local veterinarian immediately if their cows are showing signs of illness like fever or loss of appetite, and then this loss of milk production, which could really have wreak havoc on Idaho's economy and our dairymen from that perspective.
Well, and that's the thing, Christina. I think, you know, we're known as the potato state, right? Idaho potatoes.
Right.
However, dairy is a huge agricultural component of Idaho, and a lot of folks may not necessarily recognize that.
Right. It's So Idaho's dairy industry actually contributes like $3.5 billion in economic value to our state. It's obviously one of the biggest parts of our agricultural landscape. It's a huge deal if our milk cows have less production. And it was just interesting to me that Rick Nirabout, the CEO of the Dairymen's Association, said, you know, we're already coming off of a year of negative margins. So this is just really stressful on the finances, he said. And they're just trying to weather the storm that they're in. So yeah, we'll keep on top of that and continue to report if additional herds are found with this influenza. But yeah.
Okay, appreciate that. So Clark, Arbor Day is, well, we've got what, celebrations going on all over the state. Is it today?
It is today. Yeah, celebrations are going on all across the state. And Jim, this is kind of an opportunity where folks take a chance to plant a tree. And so the Idaho Forest Products Commission is giving away free blue spruce seedlings at a bunch of different locations across the state. There's a list up at the website idahoforest.org. We also had an article at the Idaho Capital Sun talking about Arbor Day. One of the events kicked off at 10 a.m. this morning at the Idaho State Museum at Julia Davis Park in Boise. And that was one of the locations where they were giving away the free blue spruce seedlings. I didn't get a chance to make it by, and I don't know if it's still going or if they have any less, but that was one of the locations. And there's also some Home Depot locations across the state where those are free. But I did just want to give people a heads up. These seedlings can grow to 50 to 80 feet high at full maturity. And so there's a couple tips out there on the website. Just be careful not to plant these under power lines or within 20 feet of your house or a major structure. Just something to think about if you're out there getting a seedling and planting a tree today to celebrate Arbor Day. Kind of a cool idea, but just really a heads up, especially under power lines. Just kind of be aware that it's a little tiny seedling today, and it could grow up to 2 feet a year if it's taken care of and eventually reach 50 to 80 feet high. But if you're interested in planting a tree to celebrate Arbor Day, there's some information online for folks there.
Okay. And hey, Ian, we've only got about less than 2 minutes left, but I want to get really quickly to last weekend's race to Roby Creek. This is an annual celebration. Some say, you know, might say it's torture, but tell us a little bit about this. And because once again, everybody comes from all over to run this race.
Yeah, so it's a popular half marathon in Boise, and it happens to be known as one of the more difficult races in the Pacific Northwest. That's because the 13-mile course, it takes runners from Boise's east end near the military reserve up more than 2,000 feet of elevation to a mountain in the foothills, and then down the backside all the way into Boise County. It's also a race that's known for its quirks and kind of eccentric atmosphere. The organizers of the race are called Sail Toads. And they pick a theme for each year's race. And at the starting line, there's usually an elaborate program before runners begin, which includes dancing and other performances. So this year's theme was Dia de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead holiday. While that holiday is normally in November, the organizers told me that the man who founded the race back in the 1970s, John Robertson, died back in November. And so they wanted to honor him and other founding runners who have died over the years. So it was beautiful weather last weekend for the race. Close to 1,900 people finished it. And the top finishers are really quite fast, finishing in just over 1 hour and 18 minutes. So that's about
That is
roughly
crazy.
6-minute miles over the 13-mile course.
Well, I will just say this before we go. I've run that race once, checked it off my bucket list, did not come in anywhere near a 6-minute mile. I want to thank all of you for your time today. We've been talking with Ian Mack Stevenson with the Idaho Statesman, Christina Lords, the editor-in-chief at the Idaho Capital Sun, and Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.